Clytus, I'm bored. What plaything can you offer me today?
Is that war rocket Ajax to bring back his body?
And welcome to War Rocket Ajax. This is the internet's most destructive comic book and pop culture podcast, and we are your hosts. I am recovering from a cold, and I'm Chris Sims. With me, as always, he's got a sinus infection. It's Matt Wilson. Matt, how are you?
We're just a couple of sick guys on the show this week.
It is a rough couple weeks for our health situation.
Is that our new blockbuster segment, health situation?
I think it is. I think it's our. Can we get Matt Fisher to write a theme song for health situation?
Hopefully, I don't sound that bad. I've been like just sick enough to not have to miss work, and I'm just sick enough that I can record the show and seemingly be okay. And I'm very glad about that because we have a really great guest this week that we're very excited to talk to. Someone that we probably should have had on the show way before now, because
honestly shocked that we have not had him on the show before now,
because he's done work that we've been fans of for years and years. He's currently the artist on Image Comics' The Fix with writer Nick Spencer. Steve Lieber is here, and we're going to talk to him about having scoundrels as characters and doing comedy in comics art, which is extremely difficult to do. And I think
and
it's
we're
going
to be talking
of
to him about his favorite aisle of the grocery store, which is fun.
That's right. So get prepared for all of that. But before we do that, Chris, we've got some business to take care of. The first of which is that we need to thank our newest supporters on Patreon.
That's right, Matt. These are the people who have gone over to patreon.com/warrocketajax and chipped in a couple bucks every month to help us keep going with the show, help unlock some bonus content for all of our Patreon backers, and help us do some exciting new things with all of your money, which we like to do. Matt, who do we have to thank this week?
First of all, we're thanking Adam Highfill.
Oh, thank you, Adam.
Next up, Savannah Holt Smith.
Thank you, Savannah.
And finally, we're thanking Chris Schwartz Brown, which is your name.
That's my name. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you to all of them and to all our other Patreon backers. If you are a Patreon supporter, you are going to get not only some bonus content from our interview with Steve Lieber later on in the show, some stuff that people listening to this episode aren't going to get. You also just got, if you're a Patreon backer, some exclusive art that you aren't going to see anywhere else by Buster Moody that is fantastic. It's gorgeous. When he sent it over to us, we were amazed by it. It's so cool.
It's awesome. And hopefully the art from actual artists is helping to take the sting out of me being a little too sick to keep up with my regular Ajax episode art, which I promise I will get back to as soon as I stop coughing.
I think that's a good goal. This art from Buster is so good. If you've seen it, you know how good it is. I think it's worth chipping into the Patreon just for that. If you can help us out, go to patreon.com/warrocketajax. Kick in a few dollars if you can. If you can't, of course, that's not a problem. You'll continue to get the show for free on iTunes and on warrocketajax.com. But if you can help out, help us out if you can. It really helps us keep paying those gimmicks they keep sending in the mail call bills. Now that we've done that business, let's do some checks and recs.
Let's do it. So come on and take it
before you wreck yourself. All right, Chris, we've got a shorter break than normal between recording. It's only been a few days since we recorded the last episode down in Sumter. But what have you been up to since then?
I have been up to nothing but sitting around my apartment being sick and watching the WWE Network. So I actually wanted to talk a little bit about something that happened at the Comic Art Symposium, because I know that we recorded the last episode the night after the symposium. You and I sat on my couch and did a little talking, but we didn't really talk about the symposium itself. Like, we didn't really talk about the events of what happened. And I wanted to talk about one of the weirdest things that I've ever heard someone say at the table.
By all means, go on.
There are now, look, this is my hometown. I grew up here. So when I say that, you know, when I say weird teens, I mean that with all affection. I was a weird teen. I was a super weird teen hanging out at the Magic the Gathering store. That's right. There used to be a store in this town that sold Magic the Gathering cards pretty much exclusively. So I know what it's like to be a weird teen in this town. Now, there was a kid who came by the table and he wanted to get a sketch from Chad. And he wanted a sketch of a thing from Undertale. Now, Matt, have you played Undertale yet? I know it's very popular, but I have not played it.
I have not played it either. I would very much like to, based on what I've seen from it. But I think it's also one of those games that, to my knowledge, is only available on PC. And I would really love to be able to play it on, like, you know, PlayStation Network. Because I think you can only get it on Steam. But yeah, I've seen a lot from it, and it does look like something I would really enjoy playing.
Yeah, it looks really, really great. I've heard it compared to Earthbound, which is very exciting. Lots of fans of this. It's kind of like the new thing. If you've been going to cons already in this con season, there's a lot of Undertale stuff that people are super into. So I feel like it is 2016's Homestuck is still around at cons, but I feel like this is Undertale's year. So this kid wants a sketch of a monster from Undertale, and for reference, he has a tablet, like he has a Kindle, I think, a Kindle Fire, and so he pulls up on his tablet like a picture of one of the monsters from the game, and it's a robot, so it's got like a little wheel. It kind of looks like Gizmo Duck, if Gizmo Duck was not a duck, if you know what I'm talking about. And he sets this down for Chad, and Chad starts drawing, and Chad says, "What is this?" And clearly he means, what is this character? What is its deal? What am I drawing here? Instead, like, there are a couple ways you can take that. You could take that as, what is this character? You could take that as, what is this device you have just put down on the table? That is not how this kid interprets this question. His response to this question, and I wrote this down in my notebook, was, it is known as a GIF. It's a picture with animation. And I thought that was delightful.
Yes, I'm glad to know that you're being informed about the graphics interchange format type of image.
Yeah, like his question, like, he assumed that Chad has never seen a GIF more than Chad has never seen this character from this video game. Like, he had to start at the basics. Matt, what have you been up to lately?
Well, I've been up to a lot. There was some fun stuff at the Comics Art Symposium. Kyle Starks and I got to talk about Kickstarter. And along the lines of the Kickstarter that I ran last year to make Copernicus Jones Robot Detective, a trade paperback, I just this week started up a Gumroad page because I've had a few people ask me who didn't get in on the Kickstarter, ask me, is there some way that I could buy Copernicus Jones without, you know, having backed the Kickstarter? And what I've said before is pretty much only when I bring it to cons, because I've just got the books with me at home. They're not like sitting at a printer somewhere or at some distribution center, you know, to be sent out. But I decided that I would take one box of books that I have and put them up for sale on Gumroad. So I'll put a link in the show notes to the Gumroad page where you can buy I think there are 33 copies left right now of Copernicus Jones Robot Detective Volume 1. If you are at all interested in that and you didn't get in on the Kickstarter, or like say you have a comic shop and you would like to to have a few copies for your comic shop or whatever, you can get those on Gumroad right now for cover price, which is $15. So go check that out if you wish. I've posted it to my Twitter a few times, and I'll put it in the show notes here. But you could probably also find it if you search for Copernicus Jones Robot Detective Gumroad. If that is something that you're interested in, I have made that available this week, and that is what I have been up to. Chris, let's make some recommendations. What do you have to recommend?
Matt, I've had a cold all week, and one of the things that happens when I have a cold is I cough. I've got a lot of, not to get gross, I got a lot of sinus drainage down my throat, and when I drink coffee, that super irritates it, and I end up coughing more, and it's a bad scene for everybody. So I have been, for the past week, going pretty hard at tea. Now, I am not a normal tea drinker. I like a little bit of English breakfast tea every now and then, but mostly tea is reserved for when I am sick. But Matt, I got a question for you. Do you know about herbal tea?
I am familiar with the concept of herbal tea, yes.
Do you know that herbal tea doesn't have tea in it?
Yeah, that's why it's herbal.
It's like, I didn't know that. No one ever explained that to Christopher J. I thought herbal tea was tea with added herbs. I did not know herbal tea was just tea made of other things, like hot herb water. Like, not actually tea.
I mean, tea is kind of hot leaf water.
Yeah, it's hot leaf water. That is how I've been describing it all week.
Yeah.
But I've been getting in on this herbal tea, and I have been drinking this orange blossom herbal tea with orange and spices. And I gotta say, I think this is gonna be a regular drink purchase at the Sullivan Sims household. It is tasty. It smells like Christmas. It's good to have. I had a little bit right before we started recording, so I wouldn't be coughing way too much. You know, drop a little sugar in it, get that orange flavor, like little hot orange cinnamon water. I like it. I am into it. I got that Bigelow orange blossom tea. You got to get on this. It's like combination Chex and Rex snack situation, tea situation segment. Matt, what is your recommendation this week?
I likewise have been sick pretty much all week. And as much of a cop-out as this is, I've kind of not had the brain capacity to do much else other than what you've been doing, which is sort of just sit around and watch the WWE Network and occasionally do work much slower than I typically do it because I've kind of had that brain haze. So I've been watching like the first handful of WrestleManias. And if you have any interest in going back and watching the early WrestleManias, the one that I would say is maybe not the most enjoyable watch because WrestleMania 3 still holds up. That Savage Steamboat match is great.
That Savage Steamboat match for being like what, like 1984, like holds up.
I think it was 87, but yeah, it holds up so well. Like, it is still such a good match. And I hadn't even really, I didn't even really remember how, cause it's often described as this like perfect, beautiful, technical match. But it's also like very much a WWF 1980s match where like managers are getting involved. And I don't think Elizabeth takes a bump, but Elizabeth is involved in it. Like acting as a distraction and stuff. So it's not like just a pure technical wrestling match. There's also like distraction stuff from the outside and you know, all of that kind of stuff too. And it's still such a great match. WrestleMania 3 holds up in a lot of ways. Now there are things about it that do not hold up at all. Like that King Kong Bundy Hillbilly Jim match that I won't describe anything else about. But it is still really worth watching. But I would also say that WrestleMania 4 is really worth watching. I don't know that WrestleMania 4 has that great of a reputation because it's a tournament. It's the tournament WrestleMania, where the World Heavyweight Championship has been vacated. And so there is just a tournament where the winner of the tournament is going to be the new champion. And it ends up being the Macho Man. Spoiler, I guess, for something that happened in 1988.
You're recommending that people watch it, though, Matt. Like, you did just spoil it.
Well, there's other reasons to watch it other than to find out who the champion is. Like, watching it in context with, like, the first six WrestleManias, which kind of had a bad time figuring out how to manage time and celebrity appearances, WrestleMania 4 kind of gets that stuff more or less right. Like, WrestleMania 5 is super weird because it has this long stretch in the middle where they do like a sketch with Roddy Piper and Morton Downey Jr. And it's so weird and makes no sense. And like, nobody comes out of it looking good. I mean, I guess Piper does, but it's really strange and such a waste of time. And then WrestleMania 6 has a musical performance by the Honky Tonk Man and Greg the Hammer Valentine debuting their new song. And it's awful. WrestleMania 4 doesn't have that. It just like really focuses in on the tournament and has a few, you know, kind of entertaining celebrity appearances. Also, Donald Trump is sitting in the front row through the whole thing, watching the matches and not clapping. Yeah. Which currently is something of interest, I guess.
I was watching, I decided to watch everything from like 2007. So I've been going through the 2007 pay-per-views, and I hit, WrestleMania 21 is 2007, and it's the one where they have the Donald Trump versus Vince McMahon hair versus hair match, where it's actually yeah. Bobby Lashley and Umaga, and it's like, that was so upsetting that I started watching all of the WCW pay-per-views from 1991 instead.
Yeah, it is very upsetting to go back and watch. But seeing like, you know, 40-year-old, or I guess 30-something-year-old Donald Trump just sitting in the front row occasionally, very occasionally applauding, and mostly not paying attention to the matches because WrestleMania 4 is at Trump Plaza, kind of surreal, but also pretty interesting.
Yeah, so I would say, no matter what side of the political spectrum you're on, that dude can't take a bump. That dude takes the worst stunner ever.
So if you're interested in watching a WrestleMania pre-WrestleMania 32, like an old one, and you've seen three recently, four is pretty entertaining. And if I'm making a medicine recommendation like you did last week, I'm going to recommend Advil Cold and Sinus. The kind that you have to sign for with the pseudoephedrine. Don't make meth with it. Take it to make your sinuses feel better. All right, Chris, those are our checks and recs. Let's talk about some comics.
Yeah, I love those.
All right, Chris, Action Comics number 50. When I finished reading this issue, I had to send you a G-chat message basically saying, you have to read this issue. This issue is so good.
Can I surprise you a little bit?
Did you not like it?
It's not that I didn't like it, because I have liked pretty much everything that Greg Pak and Aaron Cooter have done on the book. But I did feel really underwhelmed by it, which is weird because, as I'm sure we're about to point out, This is a book where Superman becomes Superman again through the power of friendship.
Yes.
So it should be right up my alley. But I don't know, like something about the story structure. I don't know if it was the Vandal Savage stuff. I don't know if it was the weirdness of seeing Superman back in his New 52 costume, but with the buzz cut. Something didn't click for me with this issue.
I find that really interesting. I mean, I will say him getting restored to his New 52 costume was not like a pivotal moment for me. Mm-hmm. But it did press a lot of buttons for me specifically. One, it was the culmination of the entire run or at least the entire story, you know, since it's been Greg Pak and Gene Luen Yang in tandem on Action and Superman, where, you know, all this bad stuff has been happening to Superman and Clark Kent. And then the curtain got pulled back and there was the reveal that, you know, the one big villain was behind it all. And that stuff is like, it's like manna from heaven to me. Like, I love that.
I think that's part of what I didn't like about it. Cause it, and again, I say didn't like, what I mean is didn't like as much as I thought I was going to, because it is, I think, a very enjoyable book. And I think it's solid. But the reveal that kind of all of those villains weren't just put in place by Vandal Savage, but were also Vandal Savage's children, that, like, I was like, oh, well, okay. Like, I kind of liked the idea that we were seeing all these new villains, you know, like Hoarder Root. I like Hoarder Root a lot.
Doesn't preclude Hoarder Root from coming back in other capacity.
It doesn't at all. But I feel like I liked him because he was new, as opposed to, in a way that I feel like tying him to an existing villain, it maybe takes away that feeling of, you know, all new, all different Superman villains. That is one of the things I was really enjoying about the run.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I get that. I personally tend to eat up that whole, like, we are bringing everything that has happened together in the run because it was all part of one big plot.
Mm-hmm.
That usually gets me. That usually, like, pulls me in pretty well. And it worked for me this time. And then there's a lot of stuff in here about how Superman has inspired people and how they have inspired him back.
That stuff is great. That stuff is looking great.
That is exactly what I want from a Superman comic.
Yes. There's Jimmy stuff in here. There's Lois stuff. There's, you know, there's his weird B team Justice League, because the Justice League's been captured, and so it's Superman and a bunch of like, you know, it's Wonder Woman and a bunch of second stringers, really.
Yeah, and they show up and say, you know, Superman doesn't have to do this, doesn't have to carry out this fight alone. He's got friends.
Yeah,
which is a great moment.
Yeah,
and you've got like, you've got kryptonite-powered Superman through half the issue, if not more, like where he knows that he is damaging himself, but he's making the sacrifice anyway to eliminate this terrible threat. Like, so much of it worked for me from a character perspective of Superman, and it feels like such a culmination of everything that this run has been from the get-go.
I feel like if the big costume change had been into his real clothes, you know, like into Superman's real uniform, I feel like it would have worked a lot better. Like, I feel like I would have gotten like an oh out of it when he showed up. That I just can't get past that armor still. That armor's weird.
Yeah, I mean, that's a box that they have been sort of forced into.
It is not the fault of anyone working on this issue.
No, if anything, I feel like Aaron Cooter has made it look the best of virtually any artist who has drawn it. But it's a tough costume to make work in any workable way.
Yeah. But yeah, I'm really surprised, because longtime listeners to the show know you and I have very similar tastes in what we like. It's very rare for one of us to like a comic that the other doesn't. And especially with this book, like I said, Superman gets his powers back with the power of friendship. Like, for it to not appeal to me as much as it appeals to you is, I think, really surprising. And I don't know, maybe I was just like, I was on Dayquil when I read it. So there's that to consider as well.
You can always blame Dayquil. Well, all right, let's move on to the next comic that we have. Gotham Academy number 16.
There is a story in this that I said, aw, out loud while I was reading it. The Gotham Academy story that we've been getting for the past three issues is the yearbook story. It's kind of the anthology story where you're seeing since they won't let MAPS edit the yearbook at school, they're making their own yearbook with a bunch of little side stories of stuff they've done throughout the year. And the opening story in this one is about MAPS trying to meet Batman. MAPS going into Gotham City and trying to meet Batman. MAPS, who is the most adorable new character in DC Comics in years, I think. Suck it, Dexstar. MAPS rules. But this story of MAPS trying to meet Batman and then falling asleep at the Bat Signal is, like, I don't want to spoil how it ends, but it's exactly the ending you think it's going to be. And it's so great. And it's the Batman that I want so badly in comics. The nice Batman. The Batman who's nice to kids but hates criminals. And story alone was absolutely delightful. And the rest of the book is solid as well. And I'm so glad that Gotham Academy seems to not only be continuing with Rebirth, but seems to be thriving. You know, we're getting the Lumberjanes crossover, which I'm super excited about. We're getting Gotham Academy second semester coming up after Rebirth. And I'm so glad. Because, you know, the thing that I said when it came out was, you better not Thor the Mighty Avenger this one up. And fortunately, it seems like all of you have taken my very grumpy advice to get it. So I'm super glad to have this. And Matt, there was one from last week that you wanted to talk about as well.
Yeah, we didn't talk about it last week because we had to kind of throw together an episode on the fly in your living room. But I took the opportunity to go back and read this issue, not only because I had read some great stuff about it, not only because I wanted to read it already, because it's another Mark Waid, Chris Somney jam, and their Daredevil run was so good, but also because I was specifically asked on Twitter if I was going to read this and was told by this particular listener that it was one of their favorite first issues of all time. And I absolutely see why. That's Black Widow number one, which came out last week. And it is such an action-heavy first issue of a comic. It is not dialogue-free. There is a share of dialogue in this issue just to kind of establish what Black Widow is up to and why S.H.I.E.L.D. is out to get her. But for the most part, it is one big action sequence and chase sequence. And it is done so well. Chris Somney has somehow taken it up a notch from Daredevil on this book, where, like, these are such, like, big screen action sequences with such great, like, fight choreography, the way that characters are positioned, the car chases are so dynamic. Everything looks great. And there's a reveal on the last page that is sort of subtle, but it's one of my favorite last page reveals. Because basically, without giving it completely away, basically it tells you that Black Widow doesn't know everything that you think she knows, or isn't coming into the situation that we're presented with in this issue in the way that you might think she would be. It's got this instant great action spy hook and does a really amazing job of being a very action heavy first issue that pulls everything off so well. And again, the art is just astonishing. I'm blown away by what Chris Somney and the colorist, Matthew Wilson, who, you know, is my mortal enemy forever, what they are able to accomplish in this, because it just looks so good. So if you missed it last week, I cannot recommend it more. It is beautiful. Speaking of beautiful art, we should get to our interview segment with Steve Lieber, and we will do that right after this break.
For the program this week, somebody I'm very excited to have on, and someone I can't believe that we haven't had on before? Is this a first time for you, Steve?
This is my first time. I've shouted stuff from the background while you were talking to Parker and Colleen and other folks. So I think my voice has been heard in the podcast, but never in an official capacity.
That sounds about right. But you will know him as the artist of some great comics, including Whiteout, Underground, Superior Foes of Spider-Man. His latest book is The Fix, out from Image Comics soon. And he is one of the best guys. I just want to put that out there. One of the nicest guys, one of the most personable people I've ever met in comics. Steve Lieber, welcome to the show. I'm so glad we finally get to have you on.
Matt, Chris, it's a pleasure to be here.
Steve, since you already brought it up, I wanted to ask, I don't hear any background noise, so I think that you're not there right now, but you, as you said, you're one of the illustrious members of Periscope Studio.
Periscopers.
Yes.
Are you there?
I am
there now?
Periscope right now.
Are you the only person there?
No, I'm sitting directly outside the studio, actually, in the space we call the vaping seat. Normally, Lucas Kettner would be right here just vaping his little heart out. But he's inside actually getting paid work done right now. So here I am just smelling the vague fragrance of the whatever Apple tobacco it is he's been smoking.
So you're not partaking in the vaping?
I'm not
getting any of that good cotton?
I have no proper vices. Carbs, I guess. That's about it. No smoking, no booze.
I gotta say, this is very upsetting because we were told that this is the start of our hot new segment, Vape Chat, where we talk about all the coolest new developments in electronic cigarettes.
God, yeah.
That people think it's okay to smoke in comic book conventions inside.
I find it endlessly fascinating. I'll admit, I actually like the smell of it. I walk by, I'm like, this, it's the same sort of, this probably isn't good for me, but I like the smell of it that you get when you walk down the laundry aisle at the supermarket. It's like, all these professionally chosen perfumes are kind of nice. This is cool.
Yeah, it's all mountain fresh.
Yeah, exactly.
Wintergreen.
All right, I'm gonna circle back to this in a second. I do want to say, because there's been a lot of vaping controversy lately. I know a lot of people are vaping in lieu of smoking.
Yes.
And that's, you know what? That is, God bless you, and good luck to you for quitting smoking. I will say I am anti-smoking. It is always shocking to me that people still smoke in the year 2016, even though, let's be real here, it does look really cool.
I don't begrudge anybody any of their vices. I mean, I'm from this long line of exploding Jews, and just one ancestor after another with a heart attack or a stroke or whatever. And yet, you put me in front of the salad bar, I go straight for the least healthy thing there and start piling that on my plate. Somehow I manage to avoid everything that's good and right for me. So if I can't make a decent choice over what I eat, then who am I to cast dispersions on anybody for what they breathe?
Well, I'll tell you who I am.
Tell me who you are, Chris.
I don't do it. Like, look, God bless you if you're vaping. That's step one. But you have to realize, just because there's no law against doing it in public, like doing it in an enclosed space, that doesn't mean it's cool to do that, right? Like, to use your metaphor, Steve,
I
assume that you don't, like, go to the salad bar and, like, load up on onions and lettuce and ranch dressing and carrots. And then walk the convention hall, like stop by people's tables and go like, "Oh, what are you working on?" While you're eating your salad. That's my problem with it. Like, that's my whole problem.
Fair enough. Your right to vape ends at my nose.
Yes, there we go. That's a good slogan. Put that on a T-shirt and make yourself $1 million.
There we go. We'll call this our first merch for this episode.
We'll save our brand new segment, "What's Your Juice, Bro," for next week. But I do want to pivot to talking about The Fix, because you talked about your vices,
yes,
or your lack thereof.
Yeah.
But you draw characters, both in The Fix and previously in Superior Foes of Spider-Man, who were sort of defined by their vices. Like, there's a lot of humor in these characters being unable to control their bad urges. And so much of the comedy of both of those books is in their body language and the way that they react to, like, you know, there's a scene in the first issue of The Fix that is inherently funny just in the setup, where our two lead characters are planning a heist in a retirement home, and there's like a bingo game, and they can't help themselves from getting involved in the bingo game because that's like a gambling thing. So where do you get the inspiration for, you know, these characters that are embracing their vices if you don't really necessarily have any of your own?
Well, I do. I got me some sloth and some gluttony.
Okay.
I can kind of extrapolate from there to the other five deadly sins. But I don't know if it's just from watching people. The funniest people I've ever known are just cheerful narcissists, folks who are completely happy about being complete shitbags, and they're fun to watch and they're fun to tell stories about. You just don't want to be in an elevator with them. Or God
I see
forbid.
Now why Steve has always been so nice to me when we've met.
There we go. Yeah,
I get it now.
Yeah, it's. Really, it's the same reason I like crime fiction. The ways we fuck up are a lot more interesting than the ways we are virtuous. Virtue is wonderful, and I support it in the world, but it doesn't make for great stories. What makes for great stories is conflict and difficulty and people getting things wrong and scrambling to try to fix it with whatever limited capacity they have. And I'm endlessly fascinated by that process.
And I mean, obviously that was an element of Superior Foes as well. Like, in that it's, I mean, if you want to talk about people fucking up, like that is the book for it.
And it still amazes me that we got to do it. You know, thank God these were all third banana characters, not even second banana. They aspire to be second banana. But nobody at Marvel had any reason to protect the image of these characters. There was no movie deal that they're worried about. No one's concerned about the long-term commercial viability of Shocker as a tentpole franchise. So we could just take a big cheerful shit over these characters and portray them in the ways that they probably are if you know them.
I mean, that's kind of surprising to me that you would phrase it like that, though, because it does, like, they do get put through a lot, and they are not super, super great people. I think that's fair. But it's also, like, it doesn't seem like you or Nick Spencer approach that book without a lot of affection for those characters. Does that just come from the same, like, the idea of, that you were talking about, of them being fun to watch?
Well, you know, it's incredibly deep affection, but it's tempered with an understanding that they're moral garbage. taking a shit all over them is too strong a phrase, and I retract it.
It's out there now, Steve.
It's out there now. Yeah, nothing to be done. Yeah. Oh God! If only I could have those words back. With so many corporate owned characters. They're allowed to have the expressive range of a Mego action figure. I swear, I did 22 years in comics before Superior Foes, and in all the years there where I was doing work for Higher Properties, I probably drew a smile on a human face 8 times. You know, really, they're just not permitted to have a range of recognizable behavior. And just being able to give somebody a bad day is still revolutionary in the superhero context. You know, 35, 40 years after Spider-Man first got a cold, it's still deeply weird to consider that a supervillain has to worry about paying rent on an apartment in Queens.
A quick aside here, and say that if people out there have not read that issue of Spider-Man where he gets the flu, that issue is amazing.
It's a great comic, yeah.
It's the one where he is revealing his identity on the cover. I know exactly the issue that you're talking about. It's one of the it is the most Spider-Man comic. Like, it's not the best one, but it is the most. It is the most Spider-Man comic.
Yeah, and the thing is, and when we're telling stories about these characters, we're in the business of making things tough for them. That's, yeah, a good story is one where your character has to overcome obstacles, and it's why it's necessary to take so many useful obstacles off the board when you're throwing shit at them is just weird to me. I'm really, really glad that God bless the editorial folks who were behind Superior Foes for letting us run with it, because they could have easily reined us in, and instead they pulled us back on maybe 3 or 4 jokes across the entire run of the book, and all of them were perfectly defensible choices, where had I been in charge of editorial, I would have told the crazy monkeys who were messing with these characters to not do that either.
Do you feel like kind of the onus of making characters like that in the fix? You literally have a scene very early on where there is a first person narrative caption from one of the characters where he says, "Hey, I'm not a likable anti-hero. Like, I'm a shitty guy." But you still have to, you know, people have to like these characters enough to keep coming back. Like, they have to like these characters enough to want to come back and see more of their adventures. That's something, like, I think you can make a movie about kind of irredeemable jerks a little more easily than you can make something that's sequential, like a TV show or a comic, because you have to have people wanting to keep coming back, even if it's only to see them get deeper and deeper into this problem, which they are certainly getting into by the end of this issue.
Yeah,
but you know, the dialogue and the story, I feel like, can only go so far in making a sort of an unlikable character likable. You know, like unlikable in an enjoyable way. And I feel like with that kind of character, almost more than anything else, like it comes down to body language, and it comes down to expression and staging and the kind of, you know, like the silliness of a guy running around in a Hawaiian shirt to commit his armed robberies and then coming back to the same place later in the same shirt. Like, that all kind of comes down to you.
I got the skills to pay the bills here. I can do this.
Oh, no, you absolutely can. Like, you know, how do you approach that challenge?
Well, I've got a couple of tools to make these characters, if not likable, then fun to watch. Number one, people like watching people who are good at things. And while they may not be good at committing crimes, Roy is great at lying. Roy can spin bullshit better than anybody in this world, and that's his superpower right there. And people will always admire somebody who's good at their job, no matter how horrible a character they are or what terrible things they do. If they're good at what they do at their primary thing, they're fun to watch. Whether that's Heisenberg in Breaking Bad or Tony Soprano in The Sopranos or any of these things. It's delightful to watch somebody be good at their primary skill. It could be unbelievably painful to watch them be bad at it. So if you're watching season 2 of The Wire and you're watching Ziggy Sabatka failing over and over at being a drug dealer, it's agonizing to watch. And so for a character like that, you have to find another way to make people want to watch them, or you have to push them to a B story. If you can turn it into a ritual, like Charlie Brown and Lucy in the football, at that point, it stops being about Charlie Brown, and the protagonist of it starts to become the cartoonist. What variation of this familiar ritual is he going to spit out for us this time? I think the reader's identification switches from the character to the storyteller when you do that. So
that is a very comics creator answer to that question.
And maybe I'm projecting a little because I think I made my transference of identification from character to cartoonist around the age of 10. But I think it's there.
So for you, did that come from Peanuts? Is that something that you saw there and realized it?
It came to me, and this is my highbrow comics literati answer here, but it came when I was 10 years old. I went to the Carnegie Library in Pittsburgh, the main branch, not the tiny local branch, but the main branch, where they had an enormous volume in the non-circulating section. You had to request it on a piece of paper, and an old man in a trundle cart would wheel it to you. But you could get this giant volume reprinting the best of EC horror, suspense, and science fiction comics. It was like the size of one of those big original art reprint books that they sell now. So it was really, really big, and it reprinted Bernie Krigstein's Master Race, a famous 8-page comic story, which has been. It's been one of the high points of the medium since it first appeared in 1955. And there's a sequence in there where Krigstein manipulates time by the way he arranges his panels. He gives you one panel where we see a subway go by, and he just draws it as this beautiful frozen blur of motion by repeating images static images next to each other. To suggest the subway moving by really quickly. So one panel gives you a ton of speed and a lot of motion in it. And then in subsequent panels, he gives you the first time I'd ever seen slow motion in a comic, where he holds the camera on a guy falling onto the subway tracks. And he takes four panels for the guy to wobble and teeter in midair as he's falling off the safe part and onto the rail, and I was suddenly, as I read this, aware that there was somebody drawing these pictures, making choices that were making a movie go in my head, and no one had ever done that before. And I went back and I reread the story again, and I started making little sketches, and I reread the story again. And I realized that he was doing things like implying a transition in sound by showing a screaming crowd at a Munich rally, followed by the scream of a subway train moving through a tunnel, which is a really similar sound. I was watching a puppet show, and suddenly I realized there was a puppeteer there, and I started watching what they were doing. And that's my secret origin right there. That was me realizing that I didn't have to become a Green Lantern. I could become the guy who draws them.
Well, you know, clearly between Superior Foes and now The Fix, something really clicked between you and Nick Spencer, especially in regards to doing comedy and physical comedy in a comic, which I feel like those are, like, comedy is one of the hardest things to do in comics, generally. And a lot of people don't even try.
Yeah, there's a lot of theoretically funny out there, it's true.
Yeah, but somehow you and Nick working together, and I don't know how much of it is his script and how much of it is you just, like, picking it up and making it funny. I always think about the scene from Superior Foes number 15, where Mark 7 is just knocking stuff around with his wings and being the ultimate klutz, and then just embarrassed, completely embarrassed, flying away. And I think about that page and I have to stifle laughing. And I think about how it's like, you know, a conductor conducting a symphony. Like, you have to hit the right notes at exactly the right times to make that funny. And somehow you pulled that off. I'd really love to know, like, how it goes from script to page and how you decide what those moments are to show for a physical comedy moment.
I can actually look up the exact script, but off the top of my head, I think what the script said was maybe put a gag about Mach 7 trying to exit.
Yeah.
Maybe put a gag?
Yeah.
See, this is, like, we had Veronica Fish on a couple weeks ago, and she was talking about how important writers are. And I thanked her for saying that. But, like, look, we all know. Like, we all know that's not the case.
Nick and I, we work really, really, really organically with each other. And it's a good way to work for books like these. Sometimes he'll write Marvel style, where it's, you know, he'll give me a paragraph or two summing up the major beats that have to occur in a scene. Sometimes he'll write nothing but dialogue with a couple of action directions, but no panel breakdowns. So I'll just get two or three typed pages of dialogue exchanges, and I can figure out, you know, where the panel breaks are, where the page breaks are, how many panels there should be, where there should be a breathing panel with no dialogue. I letter all my thumbnails as I'm going, so I can see exactly what the rhythm is. And I don't think there's any other way to do comedy as two people, because everything is about rhythm and everything is about timing. And there's no way that you could script something like that and know what you're going to get. I know what I can make funny and I know what I can't. So I'm gonna steer whatever he gives me towards the jokes that I can deliver. And it's, you know, in this context, I'm putting in a lot more. I'm doing a lot more writerly type work than I do when I'm working with, like Jeff Parker, for instance, who writes very, very visual scripts. And you know, I can even go to him and say, "How do you see this page laying out?" And because Jeff draws like a son of a bitch, he can just whip out a pencil and say, "Well, big head over here with the eye line pointing towards this," and he can compose the page in 30 seconds in a way that makes his intent perfectly clear. With Nick, it's a completely organic collaboration. There's a lot of places where it's really, really tough to say where his job as a writer ends and my job as a cartoonist begins.
Now, Steve, we've talked a lot about Superior Foes. We've talked a little bit about The Fix. We haven't actually talked about the premise of The Fix.
Oh, sure.
Which is maybe something we should get through before we go any further.
Yeah.
Now, there is a... I don't know how much you want to spoil, because I will say, there is a reveal that happens about 10 pages into the first issue. Mm-hmm. That's really, really fun.
We've talked a lot about it, and the blurb spoils the reveal. But because nobody remembers the blurb that they read 3 months ago when they actually pick up a comic, the reveal still has some impact. But I'll say that it's about two crooks who happen to be two cops for various reasons. They find themselves deeply in debt to a local crime lord, and wind up in fierce opposition with a drug sniffing beagle named Pretzels.
That covers everything in the first issue.
Well, yeah. What I was struck by throughout is how often within a single issue you guys managed to upend my expectations as a reader. Because I may have seen the thing about them being cops somewhere else, but I got to the point where they were cops and I was surprised. And then there's the reveal of the beagle at the end, and that's surprising and funny, just based on the way that he is talked about.
Yeah.
And the crime boss is a very funny inversion of the archetype of a crime boss.
I love me some Josh. I don't know if Nick, when he came up with him, was leaning into the fact that I live here in Portland, but Josh is a very Portland figure.
He is a super Portland figure.
Yes. And most of the visual gags around Josh are Nick's, not mine. He's been really, really good at coming up with great visual ideas for him.
I think the best one, there's this great page where you see the contrast between Josh's, I guess, home life and work life is what it is.
Yeah.
But in his work life, there's a part where he's putting out a guy's eye with a hot poker, which is horrifying. Like, that is literally the violence that set Frederick Wortham off.
It's an injury to the eye motif, yes. Yeah.
Yes. The best thing is, though, he's wearing oven mitts while he does it so that he can hold on to the hot poker. And there's, like, a little, like, musical notes because he's whistling. Like, that's my favorite. That's my favorite gag from that. The oven mitts are what got me.
I spent a lot of time thinking about what kind of mitts you would have, too. I drawed, like, different versions of that where he had the silicone mitts that look like big fish, and the quilted kind. I spent more time on this book on mundane details like that, you know, trying to figure out exactly what brand of coffee maker somebody would be fooling around with, rather than listening to the person they're supposed to be listening to. Or whether it's funnier to be using the correct golf club to be smacking somebody's desk ornament around, or whether they should just pick up an umbrella and do it. There's all sorts of weird exploration into utterly mundane stuff that's become a huge part of my life since I've started drawing this book.
I know that at Periscope Studio, because I'm going to brag, I've been there. It's awesome. It was great. Jeff Parker invited me when I was in Portland a couple years ago. I know you guys have, like, a prop room.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, I think, in, like, mostly it's guns, right? Like, it's prop guns, because guns are notoriously hard to draw.
Yeah.
But is there, like, a drawer just labeled oven mitts, and you've got to, like, go in and see what you got?
Unfortunately, no. Stuff like that, it's mostly just Googling. Occasionally, I will go out and buy a specific prop just to draw in a couple of panels because I want to get it exactly right. There's a bit in Superior Foes where this is a very strange sentence if you haven't read the comic, but where Boomerang expresses his defiance by the way he pours syrup on his pancakes. And I had to get the exact right syrup pitcher, dispenser, whatever you'd call it. So I went to a local restaurant supply place and convinced them to sell it to me, even though I don't own a restaurant. just dumb mundane stuff like that. I found that it's often the difference between a scene being funny and the scene just laying there. That's something that in comics I learned from David Mazzucchelli, of all people. Not somebody that you think of his superhero work as being particularly funny. The scenes in Batman Year One where I think it was the Commissioner Loeb he's got like a Charlie Brown or Snoopy doll, you know, statue on his desk, and he's constantly popping Hall's cough drops. And Mazzucchelli took the trouble to draw what a Hall's cough drop looks like, and it's like, and that brought that scene to life. I could smell the menthol coming off the page, and that's a lesson that I've tried to apply to my own stuff.
So we're going to need to pivot to our questions from our listeners on Twitter in just a second.
Oh, cool.
But before we do, one last question for you, Steve, because
sure.
I'm really interested in this. So Superior Foes ends, and you and Nick decide that you want to do another book together.
Yeah.
Was your conversation just like, okay, let's see if we can make our characters worse this time?
The conversation was Nick had three ideas, that any of which he thought I'd be good for. And one of them was one of them became this idea, and I just jumped right on it. I love cops. I love robbers. I love robbers who are cops. The moment I heard it, I knew I wanted to draw this.
You guys are just you're gonna. I mean, I don't think this is a bad thing to be known as, but I think you guys are gonna become known as the scoundrels, the scoundrel guys.
For a while, I've been describing this as my big Leslie Nielsen moment. For 22, 23 years of making comics, that was where humor went to die. I went decades without getting a laugh in comics, but without even trying to. I was always doing, very dour, very grim situations, stiff, unhappy people doing violence to each other. I was really, really excited to be presented with scripts that gave me a lot of chances to do other things. And I had no idea if I'd be good at it or not, but when it was offered to me and I started seeing opportunities to be funny, I just leaned into them.
All right. And with that, I think we're going to kick it over to our friends on Twitter to get some Twitter questions.
Hi, Twitter.
I have a sneaking suspicion that our regular listeners just missed out on some great bonus content.
You're right about that.
Okay. But if our listeners want to get in on these interviews that we do each and every week with fine folks like Steve Lieber, how can they get in on that?
Well, put your butt in the vaping seat. Get out your e-cig, stuff it with some sweet cotton, and puff away on it while you go to twitter.com and sign up for an account. Maybe your account could be the vaping seat. Who knows?
Somebody must have that.
Well, if they don't yet, they will. Follow me, the Matt D. Wilson, and Chris, the ISB. Wait until Thursday night at 9:30.
Not taken.
Wait until Thursday night at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 6:30 Pacific. One of us will put out the call for questions for our guest, and you will have the opportunity to ask a question, much like the questions you're about to hear for Steve Lieber. Our first question comes from Discord_Inc. on Twitter. James Fletcher, he wants to know, what's your favorite heist movie, Steve Lieber?
Boy, that's a good question. They all frankly blur to me. They're all the same movie. Was Sexy Beast the one with the gentleman who played Gandhi? Help.
Yeah.
I thought that was...
Kingsley.
I thought that was really, really cool. I like The Inside Man recently. I just saw, but that's not a genre I've done any ranking in.
Well, you and Nick have done a great job of putting together some heists in comics. So, bravo!
Cool. I can answer that one in books.
Okay.
For books, my favorite is Shoe Dog by George Pelicanos.
What happens in Shoe Dog?
A heist, a sweet heist.
Okay, that's all we need to know, I guess. Yeah.
The crime fiction condescending are all they're all putting their eyebrows together and furrowing them, going, yeah, yeah, cool.
All right. Our next question comes from Sequential Matt on Twitter, our good friend. Matt Diggs. Hello, Matt. He wants to know, what's Hugo up to these days?
we just hid Hugo behind the box of freeze pops in the freezer to terrify my studio mate Kat Ferris when she went in to get a snack. And because I know that she will never, ever hear this, I can say that Hugo's head is now popping out of a ceiling tile directly above the desk of cartoonist Dylan Mikotas, and just waiting for the moment when she stretches her head back and looks up and sees a tiny evil hand staring down at her.
And for our listeners who do not know, could you describe Hugo, please?
Hugo is a terrifying bald puppet. It's the Man of a Thousand Faces. It was a popular puppet toy of the 1960s. Pee Wee Herman brought him back and would wave him around a lot on the old Pee Wee's Playhouse show. And he's just a hand puppet that lives in a tall castle in the Uncanny Valley. It's an alarming sculpt, and it scares the shit out of everybody who sees it.
Our next question comes from Romcom Your Mom on Twitter, and this is for all of us. What is your favorite unconventional panel trick of all time? Romcom Your Mom says that they specifically like X-ray view panels, like Kirby's map of the Baxter Building. And there's actually a panel like that in Superior Foes as well.
Oh yeah.
When the team is about to go try to steal the Doctor Doom painting.
Yeah, I thought of that as the complete map of a side scroller game. that's a favorite trick right there. Another trick that I go to the well on this one a lot is the inset close up with an arrow pointing to what it's a close up to, and I like that for comedy, and I love it when it's done absolutely straight. It's a really, really useful tool for a number of reasons, and I like it because it's a pure comic solution. It's the sort of thing that movies are full of cuts, and they get lots of them, but they rarely do pictures within pictures, or fill in a dead area of the screen with an entirely different picture. And when they do, I don't feel like it works too well. I've seen a couple of places where multiple images on the screen have worked. I liked it in the bits in Fargo that I used that I thought made good use of it. I didn't care for it in the Thomas Crown Affair. But in comics, one picture inside another picture, it's gold.
Yeah, the arrow pointing to the detail shot is deployed very well in the fix. I really enjoyed that. Chris, do you have a favorite panel trick?
Matt, you know I love cutaways.
You do enjoy a good cutaway.
Cutaways are my fave. Like side views of buildings that are done as cutaways. Love them. Cannot get enough. Also, I love it when sound effects form panel borders.
Yeah,
that's a big fave of mine.
That was going to be my answer, when the panel is a sound effect.
Yeah.
Yeah, those big booms, you know?
I also really enjoy when the panel is, like, unconventionally shaped, but the shape is something. Like, one of my favorite examples of that recently was when I saw some panels that were exclamation marks.
Ooh, that's a good idea.
That's good.
I really like that.
One of the best solutions, one of the best uses that I ever saw was in the Jay and Silent Bob comic that Matt Wagner drew. It was like one of the first things Oni Press published back around 97. And there's a panel where the panel was just a close up of somebody's hand with a bud in the center of it, that little bud of pot doesn't look like anything. It just looks like a little lump. So to clearly identify what was in this guy's palm, Matt drew the panel border as a pot leaf. And it was that's a perfect solution right there.
That clears it right up.
Matt Wagner. He's going places in this business.
Yep. He sure is. The next question we have comes from King Impulse, our pal Kieran Chiek. He wants to know, who is everyone's favorite non-Superior Foes D-list villain? I have my answer right away.
Go for it.
It's the Grizzly. Because
he is first, a bear.
He's a former pro wrestler who got a bear costume and decided to go get revenge, which is amazing. I actually have tucked away in a digital drawer somewhere an old, old comics pitch that featured the Grizzly prominently. I absolutely love the Grizzly.
If there is any justice in this world, Matt, we will one day see that comic.
Yeah.
He's been repurposed into not the Grizzly anymore. But anyway, Chris, Steve, favorite D-list villains?
Good, Chris.
I mean, God, like all my favorite villains are D-list villains. Like I'm the dude who goes to bat for Johnny Karaoke.
I don't know Johnny Karaoke.
Johnny Karaoke appeared in two issues of Batman by John Ostrander and Tom Mandrake.
Wow.
He is a highly educated assassin who pretends to be dumb and sings karaoke songs into a cane that is also a microphone that is also a sword. And he has a trio of backup dancers with him. And he dies in his first appearance. And I want, like, that was pre-New 52. I want him to come back. New 52, Johnny Karaoke. Rebirth, Johnny Karaoke. Bring him. I love him.
That is high concept. Wow. I think it's the big guy and the little guy from the Enforcers. I snuck them into Superior Foes, but they weren't part of the team or anything.
Ox and Fancy Dan?
Yes. Because it's just ridiculous and perfect that you've got a guy who can lift a car no problem. So to fight him, you just have a 3-foot guy in a shark skin suit with no powers. Who better? And the fact that he just rides around on a big lug's shoulders, it's one of the all-time great visuals, and I adore it. I love all the early Spider-Man villains because everybody Steve Ditko drew was like somebody who could be sitting next to you at a diner. They rarely looked tough in any way. They were just big ugly louts who you might be stuck in an elevator with or something like that. Guys with terrible haircuts and if they're smart, they could be the world's worst thesis advisor or something. But they're just fascinating blue collar weirdos.
Yeah, Steve Ditko was not afraid to draw ugly people.
Oh God, yeah. He didn't really have. He had stuff that was clearly intended to symbolize attractive.
This is the
assemblage of Homo sapien features which one would recognize as attractive. But they weren't. He just had this incredibly wide cast of character actors that he could deploy, and I love looking at all of them.
Our last question is going to come from Ken Lowry. We've got a lot more, but we're running out of time, so this is going to have to be our last one.
Cool.
This question is, I always take Steve's advice to sit up straight seriously. Steve, what's got you so adamant about sitting up straight?
I had a teacher at the Kubert School, a great guy named Tex Blaisdell. In his youth, Tex was 6'5". By the time I knew him, he was about 6'1", because his spine looked like a question mark. And it was just years and years at the drawing board, not sitting up straight. Comics is a marathon, not a sprint. And if you're doing this, you got to take care of what you got. And what you've got is a spine. I've watched so many cartoonists just screw up their health, not taking that basic step of keeping their spine straight. And every year it gets a little worse and a little hard to do it right. Currently, I've got a standing desk, and I'm not preachy about it at all. I'm not one of those, oh, can't be alive forever, la, la, la. But it's so much more comfortable than sitting the way I was doing. For all those years, and I recommend it to anybody. Take care of that back.
Good advice to close on.
And don't stop vaping, for Christ's sake.
Full circle, Steve. Full circle.
Thank you very much.
We're gonna get some comments from the vaping crowd.
There goes the sponsor.
Yeah. Well, no. Vapes all day. Not sponsoring us anymore. Steve Lieber.
It's fine. Just don't do it in the con.
Steve Lieber, before we let you go, please tell all our listeners where they can find you online.
Best place to find me online is on Twitter, @Steve_Lieber, LIEBER. I'm also on Facebook. If you put Steve Lieber into the search box, I'm one of the people who will show up, probably the guy who's talking about comics. And you can find me at all sorts of conventions, including Emerald City Con coming up in a few weeks.
Our guest has been Steve Lieber. Steve, you are seriously one of the great guys in comics. Thank you so much for being on the show. And next time, it won't be 6 years before we get you on again. How about that?
That sounds great. It's been a pleasure. A lot of fun.
Thanks once again to Steve Lieber for joining us for that interview. There is a little bit of extra content out there that is coming soon for Patreon backers. But in the meantime, I think it's time that we answer some questions from you, the listeners, in our Patreon-supported listener questions segment.
That's right. This question comes from Event Fatigue on Tumblr. The question is, what is the most obviously perfect crossover a major publisher has ever done? And why is it Masters of the Universe versus New Gods?
Yeah, because I feel like Masters of the Universe, New Gods has never happened. That hasn't happened, has it? I was really surprised, and I wrote about this, I was really surprised that Batman TMNT didn't happen in 1994. Like, how did that not happen until 2016 is the question.
Yeah.
Can I be real with you, Matt?
Sure.
I really want to get into Masters of the Universe comics. Like, I don't want to get into the show. I don't want to get into the toys. I've got enough toy nonsense to keep up with all these high-end Japanese action figures that I have imported into the country. But I do want to get into, like, the mini comics and, like, the weird 80s comics. Because I feel like those appeal to me in a way that I – like, the show, which, aside from those beautiful background paintings, the show is garbage.
Yeah.
But like those I have that Dark Horse hardcover, like the mini comic collections hardcover. Like, I just need to sit down and read it, but it is a very large, very awkward hardcover.
Yeah, I'd never really got into the comics myself. I had some of the illustrated books when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. The ones that were drawn by the guy that ended up suing to say that he actually created He-Man.
Okay.
When he had just been hired to illustrate some books that filled in some He-Man backstory for Mattel.
But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of – there's that that Art of the Masters of the Universe book that I think Tim Seeley and Steve Seeley were editors on. There's a lot of internal Mattel documents about the creation of He-Man in there.
Yeah. But yeah, I've never really been able to manage to get into the comics. In 2013 – mm-hmm. There was a DC Universe versus Masters of the Universe miniseries.
I vaguely remember that. Well, the one thing that you always hear, right, is that the Masters of the Universe movie, the canon movie, is a stealth New Gods movie.
Right, yeah.
Which has made me, like, do we have a Movie Fighters movie for this week yet, Matt? Is that what we're going to watch?
I mean, it could be. It could be what we end up with.
Is it March Mattel Madness already?
I think you've already determined what we're gonna have to do.
All right, done. Yeah, like, okay, so let's get back to the original question. Are there any other big, like, obvious crossovers that you would like to see happen that seem obvious that haven't happened yet?
I mean, the real answer is that none of those things are ever going to happen. Oh, I'm sorry. He did say never done. I did misread it. I mean, that is a good one, just by virtue of the fact of how well those two things fit together. But I don't know. I don't know that there's one that I would particularly want or particularly specifically ask for, because we've kind of got, we've gotten the big ones, right? We've gotten JLA Avengers.
Right. The, which for a long time, that was the white whale of superhero crossovers. And honestly, for it being the, like the last intercompany crossover before Marvel and DC decided, nope, no more. Like, they did go out with a pretty good one. They went out on a high note with that.
Yeah, they really did. Certainly, as far as Marvel DC crossovers go, like, they've kind of done them, right? Like, I don't know that there's one that I would be clamoring for them to do again, or for them to, you know, Amalgam was probably the most fun that it ever got for me.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as like crossing other properties over with superheroes, I don't know. There's not one that would drive me like super crazy. Like, you know, we've crossed over Star Trek with superheroes. We've crossed over lots and lots of things with superheroes, and none of those crossovers ever really like got me super excited. I'm not the type of person that feels like two things I like have to be together all the time, you know?
I mean, no, look, I get that. But I do think they're like our friend Ben Gulley has often said, and I totally back him up on this, that Furious 8 should also be Blade 4. Because it's like the only thing that franchise is missing is like suddenly there's vampires. Like, I wanted the stinger at the end of Furious 7 to be Hobbs, you know, Dwayne The Rock Johnson, throwing Dom Toretto like a file and being like, you know, like, I need your help, Toretto. I'm retired. And then he looks at the file and he looks at it. And then he looks at the camera to the audience and says, oh, right, I forgot to tell you. Vampires are real. That would be the best way to end a Furious movie. As far as comics go, like, I do think, like, in terms of more recent stuff, I do feel like it would be really, really fun to do Spiral versus S.H.I.E.L.D. You know, like Grayson versus Black Widow, I think would be really fun.
But are those entities really different enough to make it not just like two versions of the same thing challenging each other?
I mean, like, Spiral and S.H.I.E.L.D. might not be, but I feel like Dick Grayson as a character and, you know, Grayson as the spy character would work really well against, like, some of the S.H.I.E.L.D. characters. Like, if it's, you know, especially, like, Black Widow, I think would be really, really fun to see. Because she's got no time for Dick Grayson. She's got no time for his nonsense. I feel like it would fit. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I could see that working, especially since Marvel has become so invested in the past 5 or 6 years in sort of the hierarchy of S.H.I.E.L.D. or S.H.I.E.L.D. becoming such a like a cornerstone of what Marvel is all about. Partially by virtue of the fact that S.H.I.E.L.D. is kind of the connecting force between all the movies and the TV shows and stuff.
Yeah, true. Crossovers are hard. Crossovers are weird.
Yeah, I think they're really hard to pull off and make them worthwhile. So
that,
I don't.
That, that
I don't,
is
I don't,
true.
I don't really know that I'm going to go around wishing for them too much.
That's a thing I've written about too, where it's like it's very difficult for a crossover to happen. And I think this might be not the case for like readers who are younger than us. Like, if you're 20 now and you're into comics, like, you're probably like wishing you could see, you know, Batman fight Captain America or Superman fight the Hulk. But like, Matt, you and I lived through the early 90s. Like, we saw it. Like, we saw the crossovers. We saw all of them.
We saw Batman spawn.
Yeah, we saw three Batman Predators. Three. Batman versus Predator happened three times, and none of it was good. No offense to anybody.
Yeah, because they're usually cash-ins. You know, it was two things before we got inundated with two things.
Yeah.
Properties.
Yeah. Now, I don't think that means that we, like I said, I'm really excited about Gotham Academy Lumberjanes coming up, because that is one that makes perfect sense.
Yeah, and I think that that will be put together with some care. Yeah, the problem with all those crossovers in the early 90s was that there was no care behind them. It was just like, hey, people, this thing's popular and this thing's popular. Put them together.
Yeah. Like, the ones that, like, really hold up are RGB Meets the Punisher, which is one that, like, you know, has the this would be so weird if we did this. Like, how could we possibly make this work? And then they had to figure it out. And honestly, Judge Dredd versus Predator, where Judge Dredd teams up with Dutch's great-granddaughter to fight the Predator. That's pretty great. But those are, like, the only ones.
I mean, I guess I'd be interested in seeing Squirrel Girl crossed over with a lot of different things. But particularly, like Squirrel Girl put in a very, very dark universe where she is kind of the guiding light that turns everybody around. Like, if you put Squirrel Girl in Judge Dredd. Like, that might be really entertaining.
Maybe so. Maybe so. I do want the reboot Archie comics to get weird. Like, I like them. I like them a lot. I feel like everybody on those books is doing great work, obviously. But I do want those books to get weird again. And I feel like a way for them to get weird again would be to do a crossover.
I mean, they got to establish themselves. I'm sure they'll get pretty weird pretty fast.
Jughead Squirrel. That's what I want. That's what I want.
That one feels right. That one does feel right. Okay, one more question. This is going to be a fast one. This one's from Spuds Fan on Tumblr. Since there was a brief revival in the early 80s, do you think they should have made Superman 3 in 3D?
No. Because 3D movies are terrible.
Well,
but I will say the scary parts of Superman 3 would work really well in 3D.
The part that I watched over and over again as a child,
the body horror section,
and that shaped so much of who I am, where the lady gets sucked into a computer and covered in and made into a robot lady, to the point where when I was like 19, I made a mixtape for a huge group of people, or a mix CD that was called Songs for That Lady in Superman 3 Who Got Pulled Into a Computer and Turned Into a Robot.
Didn't look up her name?
I thought it was funnier to say it was that.
I mean, fair. That's very funny.
But anyway, that was such a pivotal shaping part of everything that I'm about. And that's kind of out of a 3D movie already. You know, like the way that she like bursts out of the computer and sort of stomps forward with her arms out. Like, it's very like 1950s monster movie 3D almost in the way it's shot and everything else. But also I didn't see Superman 3 in the theater. I was a fetus, or maybe I had just been born. So, like, I only saw it on home video anyway. So I wouldn't have gotten any of the 3D effects.
I think Superman 4 should have only been a stage play.
It sort of feels like a stage play.
In parts, it certainly does.
When they're fighting on the moon?
Yes. Superman 4. Better and worse than you remember, everybody.
Superman 4 was the first movie that I remember seeing in the theater and thinking, this isn't good.
Yeah. You're not wrong.
Like, I had enough cognitive ability when I was 4 or 5 or however old I was when Superman 4 came out to be sitting in the theater and like lean over to my mom and be like, is this a bad movie? And my mom was like, yes.
Good call.
All right. Those are our listener questions for this week. Thank you for sending those in, Event Fatigue and Spuds Fan. If you would like to send us a listener question, you can do so on Tumblr by going to our Tumblr, which is warrocketpodcast.tumblr.com. You can also send in listener questions at our email address, which is warrocketpodcast@gmail.com. That is also where you can send every story ever lists, panel president lists, and just if you have general comments, if you want to sponsor the show, whatever else, that is where you can get in touch. Be sure to go to our website, which is warrocketajax.com. That is where you can stream the show, download the show, read show notes, and leave comments. Also, check us out on iTunes. If you go to iTunes and you search for War Rocket Ajax, that is where you will find the show. If you like the show, leave us a review. The more positive reviews we get, the more we are featured. And now, Chris, we've reached the part of the show where we tell you all the different places you can find us on the internet. About.me has changed substantially to the point where we cannot list links to all our stuff there anymore. So we can't just send you there. But you can find most of what I'm doing if you just follow me on Twitter. That is, you go to twitter.com and you follow the Matt D. Wilson. That's me on Twitter. And that is where you can find me joking around and also sending you, giving you links to all the stuff that I'm doing. Chris, where can people find your stuff?
X-Men 92 in paperback is out now at your favorite local comic book store, at your local bookstore, at amazon.com. It would mean the world to me if you would pick it up. If you have been waiting to get it in print until it was in paperback form, that the time is now, in the words of the great John Cena. It has a cover price of $16.99. It's got some of the variant covers from David Nakayama in there, which are great. And it is the perfect way to get ready, because X-Men 92 Ongoing number one is coming out on March 30th. Chad and I are going to be doing a couple of signings and a couple of events around here in the South. We're going to be doing Durham, Chapel Hill, Columbia. Plus, we've got all our cons coming up. So if you would like to get it and you're in the area, come see us at one of those. I'll keep everybody apprised of where we're going to be signing and doing stuff here on the show. Also, it would mean the world to me if you would tell your local comic book store that you wanted it, especially if you tell them you want number two as well. Make sure you get those orders in on number two, everybody. That'll be out next month. Other than that, you can find me every day at Comics Alliance. You can also find links to some of the things I do still at about.me/Chris Sims. Other than that, the ISB on Twitter, the ISB.tumblr. And right here on Ajax, Movie Fighters, and Sailor Business, the other podcast that I do. That about does it for War Rocket Ajax number 295. We are closing in on number 300. Who knows what'll happen? Who knows? Like, maybe there'll be new hosts. Maybe everything will change. Maybe we'll go back to a new number one again. We've done that before. That was pretty fun. Who knows what we'll do when we hit Ajax number 300? Why don't you let us know what you think we should do? Send us an email. Next week, we got a great guest. We have a genuine legend coming up next week. I'm very excited about it. Not going to spoil it, but next Monday, when this hits your feed, it's gonna be big.
Chris, could it be a legend of tomorrow?
It could be a legend of tomorrow. It could be several legends of tomorrow, in fact. It's going to be a good time. Do not miss next week's episode. Join us for that. Until then, have a great week, everybody. We'll see you next time.
Yeah! It's for every one of us. It's not for every one of us. It's not everybody, every man, every woman, every child, everybody, flash. We learn everything to Flash. Stay on.